The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, the president seems serious about confronting a deadly growing epidemic.
The administration's going to be rolling out policy over the next 3 weeks, and it'll be very, very strong.
We'll hear from Andrew Sullivan, whose outcry should shake America to its core on the depth of the opioid tragedy.
I think you have to look at widespread social and cultural trauma. A collapse of religion, a collapse of a family that has led people into this wilderness of despair.
The president's proposed steel and aluminum tariffs have roiled the markets and more than a few economists. We'll hear from Stephen Moore.
From the start, when I started working with Donald Trump as an advisor back about 2 years ago, he and I parted company on this trade issue, and I think these in particular are highly counterproductive.
There are some, however, who applaud the move, citing history as a precedent.
That's how America was built. We started off as 13 agricultural colonies, and 100 years later, we were the greatest industrial empire the world had ever seen, and this was behind a tariff.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The tragedies come and they go. The Parkland shootings, the Las Vegas carnage, ISIS murders by the hundreds. But one terrible tragedy is ubiquitous and has been with us for years and is growing more intense. The president just spoke at the White House Opioid Summit. He seemed angry as he compared this epidemic to others.
Drugs are a similar but different problem in the sense that we have pushers and we have drug dealers that don't. I mean, they kill hundreds and hundreds of people, and most of them don't even go to jail. You know, if you shoot one person, they give you life, they give you the death penalty. These people can kill 2,000, 3,000 people, and nothing happens to them. And we need strength with respect to the pushers and to the drug dealers. And if we don't do that, you're never going to solve the problem. If you want to be weak and you want to talk about just blue ribbon committees, that's not the answer. The answer is you have to have strength and you have to have toughness. The drug dealers, the drug pushers are, they're really doing damage. They're really doing damage.
Andrew Sullivan, a brilliant, often controversial cultural commentator, wrote passionately of this plague in the New York Magazine. Entitled The Poison We Pick, illustrated by a photo of a beautiful poppy, an opium poppy, Sullivan laid out a sobering, ugly picture. Sullivan was a guest on the Michael Medved Show.
Andrew Sullivan has a terrific new piece. It is called The Poison We Pick. The scale, the sheer scale of the suffering that you write about in your piece, which actually gives some perspective on the history of this entire addiction, this entire American curse. One paragraph leaped out at me. You write, when we see the addicted stumbling around like drunk ghosts, or collapsed on sidewalks, or in restrooms, their faces pale, their skin riddled with infection, their eyes dead to the world, we often see only misery. What we do not see is what they see. In those moments, they feel beyond gravity, entranced away from pain and sadness. The very essence of the appeal of opioids, of oxycodone, and so many of the others, is what exactly, Andrew Sullivan?
It's an escape from pain. I mean, that's what this drug at its essence really is. It's a pain killer. And that makes it different than other drugs, which might make you energetic or aggressive or positive. This is a drug people take because they're miserable and they want somehow not to tackle that or to engage life more fully or to do something that might actually provoke and promote their activity, but they do it to drop out, to disappear, to give up, to surrender. And they do it partly because the experience of opium or opioids in various degrees has always been, I mean, since the beginning of human civilization, an incredibly attractive, seductive form of intense pleasure. You can see Homer marveling at it. You see it in ancient Greece. You see it in Egypt. You see it in Neolithic remains 6,000 years ago. This substance, this comes out of a little poppy flower, has proliferated everywhere, and it's always had attraction for human beings. And yet, at the same time, from the very beginning, from the ancient Greeks themselves, they understood that this was also terribly dangerous. That the pleasure it gives you makes you indifferent to life and death, even. That it's one of the most potent substances humans have ever come across, the most tempting. And at this point in human history, our minds, our brains have been able to finesse it, to process it, to actually create more and more intense and concentrated forms of it, that at this point are killing tens of thousands of people, young, middle-aged, old, from different racial backgrounds, but primarily right now in the heartland of this country, the very heart of it. And I think those of us who live on the coasts or live among cultural elites or multicultural big cities care about these people because we don't know many of them. And in the same way that in some ways people ignored AIDS when it started, the deaths from AIDS, because these people were other, these people were not part of our lives, these people were also doing things you disapprove of, like shooting themselves up or having sex with too many people, we just push it out of our minds. These are our fellow citizens. They're our fellow human beings. What's happening to them is also happening to their families and their communities in a way that is, I think, more devastating than any previous drug epidemic.
That's incontestably true, that this is the most serious drug epidemic I think that we have ever had. I don't think that any Americans are so isolated in some kind of elitist bubble that we don't know. I know people who have battled opioid addiction. There are people in talk radio who have had opioid addiction very publicly. I think it's become ubiquitous when you have 66,000 people dying every year, which is more than the total number of murders and suicides and traffic accidents combined, right?
Yeah. It's why this country alone, of all developed countries, is seeing its actual lifespan reduced 3 years in a row for white people in America and 2 years for everybody in America.
So what do we do about it, Andrew?
Well, I think you have to look at widespread social and cultural trauma, a loss of meaning, a collapse of religion, a collapse of the family, and a collapse of meaningful work that has led people into this wilderness of despair.
For more of the Andrew Sullivan-Michael Medved conversation, go to townhallreview.com. While you're there, be sure to sign up for the podcast and never miss an episode of the Town Hall Review. One of the most destructive drugs fueling this epidemic is fentanyl, which mimics opioid but is synthetic and vastly more potent. My home state of Ohio, smack in the middle of America's heartland, has been ravished by the fentanyl invasion. The drug comes to us from offshore, China and Mexico primarily, through the U.S. mail. I spoke recently with another Buckeye, Senator Rob Portman, about the STOP Act, the congressional effort to address this life-ending menace. On vacation, I read Jonah Goldberg's new book about the crisis that America faces. One of the aspects of that crisis is a generation that is being hollowed out by synthetic fentanyl. What would STOP do, the STOP Act, STOP Act, do?
Well, first, thanks for your focus on this issue over the years, Hugh. And yes, in our state of Ohio and around the country, the new risk, the new danger is this synthetic form of opioids called fentanyl or carfentanil. And unbelievably, it's coming in from other countries by our U.S. mail system. And the STOP Act is very simple. It says, okay, let's stop the Postal Service from allowing this poison to come into our communities without checking these packages. You can't check them now because, for the most part, there is no information about these packages, where they're from, what's in them, where they're going. So all we're saying to the post office is this is a national crisis. Come on, let's modernize our post office. Let's use this advanced electronic data to our law enforcement officials so that they can help us stop some of this poison from coming into our communities.
You know, Senator, I keep handy a November 3rd, 2017 article from the Columbus Dispatch. Prosecutor, three men caught with enough fentanyl, quote, to kill all the residents of Columbus, close quote. They had 4.5 pounds of fentanyl, which is, you know, when you cut it, it really is enough to kill everyone in Columbus.
It's scary. You know, the fact is a few flakes of this can kill you. It's 50 times more powerful than heroin, as bad as heroin is. And there's so many stories, Hugh. You know the one about East Liverpool where the police officer pulls over a couple of guys. They have white powder strewn around their car. They tried to hide the fentanyl. Wisely, he put on a mask and gloves, arrested them, and as he was booking them down to the station, he's talking to his colleagues. He looks down on his shirt, sees a few flecks of something white, takes his hand and flex it off his shoulder, immediately falls to the floor unconscious, has to be revived three times with Narcan, overdoses. His police chief said he would have been dead had they not been right there. Think if this guy had gone home and hugged his kid. I mean, that's how powerful this stuff is. It just touched the tips of his finger, and he overdosed. And we have lots of examples of young kids, you know, going to someone's home, one, a 12-year-old going to a sleepover in Columbus and dying of a fentanyl exposure that somebody left out. So this is dangerous stuff for first responders, obviously for our community, for kids, families. I mean, we've got to get on it.
Now, let me also ask about country of origin. It is primarily China, though I understand a lot of it is also being synthetically created in Mexico. Is there no response from the Chinese government? This is not something you can really hide in this kind of production capacity. We're talking about hundreds of pounds were seized in Baja the week before I left. Hundreds of pounds. So it's not really something that's secret.
No, it's not. And we've taken them to task on it. They have said they're cracking down more. But honestly, they need to do more. We know most of it's coming from China. We know what's being produced in these chemical companies by some evil scientist. There's so much money in it, and it's so horrible what it's doing to our communities and to our families. And it's the new threat. More people died in Ohio last year from fentanyl than heroin and prescription drugs combined. 58% of our overdoses were from fentanyl.
It's a tidal wave. When I tell people the numbers that it's larger than AIDS was at its largest moment. They don't believe me, but it's true. And you're the first guy to tell me about this, and I didn't quite believe you. But since I've dug into it, 64,000 people died last year. And as you just said, more than half are fentanyl.
Yeah, 64,000 more than we lost in the entire Vietnam War in 1 year from overdose deaths. It is overwhelming. Three things. One, we need to do better on the supply side, and that's the STOP Act and other things to keep it out. But two, and more importantly, we need to do much more on the demand side, prevention, education, you know, letting these people know who are dabbling with this stuff, this is going to ruin your life and potentially kill you. And then third, on the treatment side, you're right, our treatment is not where it should be. This is not a typical cocaine type or marijuana even type story. This is more about, and not saying some people don't choose to take the drug at a party, but for a lot of people, they get into this through the prescription drug. The overprescribing has taken hold in this country over the last decade and has caused a lot of this pain.
Coming up.
When it comes to the steel and aluminum tariffs, I think these in particular are highly counterproductive.
Tariffs from both sides. When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In January, the revitalized economy was rolling, pointing towards a 3+% GDP in 2018. However, with roaring markets and rising wages, the president seemed to want to slow things down by threatening steel and aluminum tariffs. He had promised during the campaign to get tough with China and with other people who were illegally taking advantage of Americans' open trade borders, but this surprised everyone who watched the campaign closely, but economists got very edgy very fast and markets plummeted. Here's my colleague Larry Elder with Heritage Foundation economist and presidential advisor Stephen Moore.
In the Wall Street Journal, Stephen Moore, as you know, put out a scathing editorial about President Trump's attempt to slap tariffs on steel and on aluminum.
I did read the editorial. I've been very much in favor of almost everything Trump has done on the economy so far, from the tax cuts to the deregulation to the promoting American energy. But, from the start, when I started working with Donald Trump as an advisor back about 2 years ago, he and I parted company on this trade issue, and I had hoped that his bark would be worse than his bite. But when it comes to these steel and aluminum tariffs, I think these in particular are highly counterproductive, because it's not going to, in my opinion, Larry, even save jobs. Mm-mm. Because, yes, you know, you might save some of the steel and aluminum jobs, but what about the 6 million American manufacturing workers and computer workers and technology workers who use steel in the production of the goods and services that they use? Now they're going to have to compete in global markets with steel that's 25% more expensive than what the Chinese and German and Mexicans are using. It just doesn't make any sense.
Stephen, he's given essentially three reasons for doing this, and I want you to deal with all three. One of them is dumping. One of them is the alleged trade deficit that we have with all these countries. And the third one is national security, neither of which, in my opinion, is a compelling argument. What do you think? Let's deal with dumping first.
Well, dumping, that's the allegation that's made, especially about aluminum. And they're also saying that the aluminum, that you have these government-subsidized industries in China and other countries. And I have to confess, I don't know a lot about the aluminum market, but let's say they are. So, in other words, you know, their government is subsidizing the sale of aluminum to us. I mean, would we complain, Larry, if they gave us the aluminum for free? Yeah, I really honestly believe Donald Trump's heart is in the right place here. I mean, I think he really does care about the Ohio and the Pennsylvania and Michigan steel workers and so on. But I think he's just misguided. And on the trade deficit, look, you know when the trade deficit goes down, Larry?
When? When the economy goes down.
When we have a recession.
Yeah, when the economy goes down.
When we have a recession.
Right.
I mean, the trade deficit is almost exactly correlated to growth. When mm-hmm. the economy is growing and we've got a lot of jobs, American consumers are spending money, the trade deficit goes up. And, you know, back in 2008 and 9, when the economy crashed, our trade deficit went away.
Right.
I don't understand the timing of this. I mean, everything's going so well with the American economy right now. Mm-hmm. I just thought the timing was odd. But no, we should not worry about the trade deficit. Because, by the way, every dollar of a trade deficit is a capital import surplus. So companies, you know, foreigners are investing money in America right now. And to get the dollars to invest here, they have to sell us more goods
right.
Than we sell them, as Arthur Laffer would tell us.
And we only get about 2.2% of our steel from China. So how can that be a national security threat if they all of a sudden stop sending it?
Well, because it isn't. And I think that's a phony argument. And they use that argument because they wanted to be able to invoke these various rules that allow the president to unilaterally impose these tariffs. And by the way, a tariff is just a tax.
It's what it
you
is.
You know that, Larry.
That's
a tariff is just a tax. Mm-hmm. Consumers are going to pay this. I'm going to make a prediction on your show. This will cost more jobs than it will save.
If you look long and really hard, you could find a pundit or two who spoke admiringly about Mr. Trump's decision. Pat Buchanan, who served in several administrations, has written many books, including one on trade policy. Well, he was enthusiastic. Pat spoke with my Salem colleague, Mike Gallagher.
When I saw the media breathing into brown paper bags over these tariffs and seeing all the hysteria going on, I thought, I wonder what Pat Buchanan's perspective is. And, of course, sure enough, I read your work. You basically are saying, take a big deep breath. Why are the Republicans so terrified of tariffs?
Well, this is as American as apple pie. I mean, tariffs were the way that the United States, from the time of Hamilton, who believed in economic nationalism, through Madison, through Henry Clay, through Lincoln, through McKinley, through T.R., through Cal College. It was behind a tariff which provided the revenue, most of the revenue for the federal government, where we had no taxes on income, no taxes on corporation. That's how America was built. We started off as 13 agricultural colonies, and 100 years later, we were the greatest industrial empire the world had ever seen, had outstripped Great Britain and all of Europe put together. And this was behind a tariff. And a tariff is simply a tax. And it's a preferable tax because the tax is on foreign-made goods and it's not on American-made goods. The last 25 years, I argued against George H.W. Bush. The last 25 years, the United States has run $12 trillion in trade deficits with China, with Japan, with Canada and Mexico, and with the European Union.
Right.
And that has been a vast hemorrhaging of factories, of jobs, of plants, of investment, of technology abroad. If you want to know why Shanghai, which I visited with Nixon in 72, which was a dark, dank place, is suddenly a gleaming city, and Detroit looks a little different than it did in 1945, you can attribute it to these massive trade deficits the United States has run. A trade war has been conducted against us, and these invaders have looted all of us of all these factories. Mike, in the first decade of the 20th century, from 2000 to 2010, We lost 55,000 factories.
Right, right.
We lost 6 million manufacturing jobs. If you want to know why Trump is president, it's because what we predicted in those campaigns in the 90s has come to pass, and it's now people in every state are saying, you know, what happened to that factory down the road we depended upon? Where did that plant go?
You know,
it probably went to Mexico, Southeast Asia, or China.
This all boils down to economic nationalism versus globalism. And I know from hosting this radio show and listening to people all through the campaign, there are lots of people who voted for Donald Trump for this very reason. They're tired of seeing us on the losing end of these economic bargains and these trade deals. Like you said, for Jeff Flake to say you only lose trade wars, yeah, that's right. We've been losing all along. It's an uneven playing field. Isn't this really why? I mean, what fascinates me is the guy got elected on this. He talked about it all throughout the campaign, and then suddenly they all get the vapors when he says, you know what, I'm going to pull the trigger on doing something that I promised I would do.
Exactly. And again, first off, there's the complaint they're going to get from some of their industries phoning and calling them because they're going to say steel's costing a little more. Secondly, who is the economy for? I mean, why did Hamilton and these other try to build an economy where Americans who were totally dependent upon Britain and France, we didn't make a thing.
Right.
Why did he build an economy where Americans would come to depend upon one another, as he said, for habitation,
right,
for defense, and these things? He wanted us to come together as one nation and one people, and one way to do that is to have free commerce all among ourselves and between each other, and basically to end our reliance upon European powers, particularly the British, to make sure we could defend ourselves that next time we wouldn't defend on French ships, French muskets, and French uniforms. And it's a whole idea to make us one nation and one people and tie us all together. And have you can have foreign products come into the United States, the wealthy especially, but you're going to pay a tax.
Right, right.
This is our market.
Right.
It's an admission fee.
Right.
I mean, just like college kids. If you go to the University of Virginia and you live in Virginia, you get in-state tuition and free tickets to the Virginia games.
Right.
If you come from outside,
right,
you pay a price
of out-of-state tuition.
For Mike's entire interview with Pat Buchanan, go to townhallreview.com. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's a unique graduate program impacting policy decisions today, preparing public leaders for tomorrow. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, Dennis Prager.
Society is so free, these people don't know what to do with themselves. They need meaning.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Although Antifa, the so-called anti-fascist demonstrations, have not dominated headlines recently, they are very much alive. The irony is, Antifa groups tend to behave like fascists, using character assassination, sometimes physical threats or actual bodily harm. Now it seems they've graduated to law school. Here's my colleague, Dennis Prager.
Christina Huff Summers, who is one of the most gentle women, she is a woman, she is an intellectual, she is a truth seeker, she is the antithesis of a rabble-rouser, and she spoke at Lewis and Clark Law School. And I'm sure, I can't believe they're going to keep the name Lewis and Clark. No, in Oregon. I believe it's in Oregon. And I watched their shutting her down, singing, "Whose side on you are you on?" It's in Portland, yeah. It is in Oregon. Yeah. And they issued a letter before she came calling her a fascist. This is the left. This is what the left does. Not liberals. But you know what? The problem with liberals, they don't fight the left. That is the Achilles heel of liberalism. They only fight the right. The shutting down of speech. This is just that it's an amazing thing here. The shutting down of Christina Huff Summers, it's because she has said that, you know, I guess it's over her statement that there isn't a rape culture as such. And they put out this letter that, of course, they're for protecting free speech, these leftists, but not for speech that will lead to violence. And here's the letter: refuse fascism in all its forms. We have recently become aware, this is the National Lawyers Guild, Lewis and Clark Student Chapter. National Lawyers Guild is essentially a communist organization. All right? They don't call themselves communist, but that's their value system. We have recently become aware of a troubling event being held within the confines of our community. Under the guise of open debate and free discourse, the Federalist Society found it necessary to unilaterally invite a known fascist to our campus to encourage what we believe to be an act of aggression and violence toward members of our society who experience racial and gender depression. See, this is the great lie, as I call it, the great libel, like the Jews who were accused in the Middle Ages of killing Christian children to use their blood to bake matzahs, the Passover unleavened bread. This is what we have today. The left is engaged in this great, gigantic libel against America. It oppresses racial and gender depression. The society is so free, these people don't know what to do with themselves. They need meaning. That's what it is about. They don't have meaning. The radical secularization of their lives, they have to find meaning. Christina Summers has repeatedly made remarks in order to delegitimize the suffering felt by women across the world and to embolden male supremacist groups, including the men's right activist movement and Milo Yiannopoulos. Summers has called the epidemic of sexual assault on campuses and the gender wage gap myths. They are myths. The gender wage gap is a myth. But can you imagine that? If you say it's a myth, you're a fascist. The left, and I use this word very carefully, has raped the words, the vocabulary of moral discourse. That is what the left has done. You say that there isn't a wage gap, and you're a fascist? Refuses to recognize genderqueer and gender nonconforming persons and denies the existence of male supremacy. Wow. Yep. I tell you, we walk around here and this, I'll tell you, the Living Martyr and Triple G and I, every day before the show, we go, we're supreme. I don't know how do they know this, though? I thought it's a male right that is completely closed off to the female world. So they disrupted her speech. This is what is happening on the campus. It's being ruined by these people of the left. I'm gonna say something. I think I alluded to this, and it's just a question. If it's more than a question, in other words, if I'm right, then that is worthy of its own sociological analysis. Whenever I watch these demonstrators and those shouting down people, it seems that there's a disproportionate number of female students. Now, you might say, well, of course, because they're the oppressed. But I still find it interesting.
Coming up.
All I can tell you is China is the problem, and we're letting China off the hook. We've turned the world against the United States rather than leading the world against China.
Senator Lindsey Graham when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Lindsey Graham, the senior senator from South Carolina, ran for president in 2016, bringing humor and wisdom to a wild campaign atmosphere. Senator Graham has made valuable contributions on a number of policy areas during his extended time in the Senate, but nowhere more than his work on foreign relations and the military. We had a wide-ranging conversation this week on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Let's talk about the president. Here's my analogy, Senator Graham. Donald Trump is an excellent golfer on a very difficult course he has never played. He's got a different caddy on every hole, and some of them are drunk. And some of them have never been on the course, and some of them are very good. And on tariffs, he's got the drunk guy who's never been on the course. Agree or disagree?
Well, I would say it's not that simple because for 20 years he's been saying this. So you can't blame the drunk caddy. He's been saying this during the campaign since the 80s. What he's done, the world is against the United States. We should have the world against China. So he's identified the problem years ago that China manipulates their currency, intellectual property theft, they dump steel. his solution is to go after the European Union, Canada, and Mexico, and other people who are not the problem. That's his mistake.
I agree. Now, there is a belief on some people's part that this is a negotiation tactic in NAFTA and for the benefit of Rick Saccone in the special. Do you think he'll back off of this when the details are revealed?
I hope he will reconsider the approach to the problem, which is China. I wish he would come up with an approach that focused on China's intellectual property theft,
yes,
manipulation, and dumping, and abandon international tariffs, worldwide tariffs, which hurt American consumers and our allies.
Have you seen that the first two retaliations are aimed at Harley-Davidson motorcycles, which are in Wisconsin, and at Bourbon, which are in Kentucky? So how long is it going to be till somebody figures out they attack a Trump property abroad?
Well, not very long. So Bush did this under 201, not 232. Remember, this is a national security decision, which the Pentagon disagreed with. They believe that the 25% tariff on all steel products throughout the world actually hurts our allies, and the Department of Defense actually argued against this approach. It's just a matter of time till agriculture gets hit in retaliation. We make more BMWs in South Carolina than any place in the BMW chain. If you tax cars coming in to America from Europe, guess what? BMWs made in South Carolina are going to get hit with a tariff overseas, and that will destroy BMW's model of doing business in South Carolina.
Am I also not correct that the cost of every airplane that Boeing makes in South Carolina is going to go through the roof?
Yes, and we make more tires than any place in the nation. 32% of all the tires exported from the United States are made in South Carolina, and most of the steel that goes in those tires are not readily available in the American steel industry, so you have to go overseas to buy it.
Well, speaking of drunk caddies, Peter Navarro is a friend of mine. I've known him for 20 years. He is an anti-development, anti-developer left-winger who ran for mayor in San Diego with the hardcore left-wing rhetoric and ran for Congress with Hillary Clinton at his side. I know him well.
Is your friend?
What?
This is your friend?
Well, he lives in Orange County. I know everyone in Orange County. He's very affable, very nice, but he doesn't know a lick about this stuff, Senator Gray. He's the drunk caddy.
Well, all I can tell you is that China is the problem, and we're letting China off the hook. We've turned the world against the United States rather than leading the world against China, and I hope the White House will come up with an agenda to go after China, not the world at large, which will hurt the American consumer.
Okay, we've covered Rick Grenell, we've covered China and trade and the tariffs. Let's move on to FISA very quickly. Trey Gowdy and Bob Goodlatte sent a letter to the Attorney General of the United States asking for a special counsel on the FISA deal. Robert Mueller can't handle it because it's his buddy Comey's involved in it. You have sent a letter with Charles Grassley. Now we've got four senior members of the Republican Congress. Why will the Attorney General not do the obvious thing?
I think probably Sessions had to recuse himself from even making this decision because you're talking about investigating the campaign you ran against. It's probably Rosenstein who should make this decision. I can't believe that we're not going to have a special counsel in these circumstances. The Department of Justice and the FBI got off the rails. They can't investigate themselves. The Inspector General is a fine fellow, but he doesn't have the institutional power really to do an investigation to deal with people who are not currently employed at the Department of Justice. If there was ever a moment for a special counsel, it is now.
Well, Rod Rosenstein should be recused from this, too, because it goes to the conduct of the Department of Justice during his tenure as a member of the Department of Justice.
Well, he was in the chain of reauthorizing the FISA warrants. I can't stress this enough. Mr. Steele was a paid operative of the Democratic Party. Fusion GPS was being paid by the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign. He used his Russian sources, money given to him by the Democratic Party in America, to go out and dig up dirt on Trump. Dossier is totally unverified, and he had a political agenda, and this is a dangerous precedent to set.
Okay, last question.
The agents in charge hated Trump and skewed the investigation, I think, favorably to Clinton in terms of the email investigation.
You just answered my last question, because that's where it eventually goes, and that's why there is reluctance to look back, because it will expose the Department of Justice in manifest ways.
I think there was corruption at the Department of Justice in terms of handling the email investigation of Clinton. I think they had a political bias that resulted in ignoring facts that would have put everybody else in jail who had done those things. And I think the warrant, FISA warrant application, is right to the core. The only evidence they really had was a dossier prepared by a guy on the payroll of the Democratic Party, and they never really informed the court.
Not You're absolutely right, and I hope that if the Attorney General is recused, he ought to announce that, and if Mr. Rosenstein's in charge of this, he ought to be questioned about it when he comes before your committee. Let's go to actually the most important thing, which is the head fake by Kim Jong on nukes. Do you buy this at all?
I don't know. I think the president deserves credit for his approach to North Korea, drawing a line in the sand saying, I'll never allow you to develop an ICBM with a weapon on top to hit America. Policy of denial is the right policy. Containment won't work. They'll sell whatever they build. So containment's the wrong approach. Denial is the right approach. Now, he's put a lot of pressure on North Korea, but this will be the fourth time we've talked about giving up your nukes or in a guarantee that we won't try to attack or replace the regime. This is not the first time this has been put on the table. Every other time, it was all a head fake.
Okay, so I am very, very skeptical. We have never, I think, taken the step of disintermediating them from the banking system. Ought we to do that, Senator?
Yeah, and I think the next step is to have a naval embargo because they're still getting money and, you know, trading with Russia kind of a one-off. So the next thing to do is a naval embargo of North Korean ports where you can check goods coming and going to make sure they don't avoid the sanctions.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, where they are preparing leaders for the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
The reason that they assume that higher income, past a certain point, no longer contributes to happiness and may even lead in the wrong direction is that people work longer hours and greater responsibility just basically trying to protect your investments.
Surprising happiness stats. And the final segment of the Town Hall Review. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. We've heard that money cannot buy happiness, likely from a parent or a pastor or even good friends. It seems that many of us are not convinced of that truism. Maybe that's why we often don't hear of gambling casinos or lotteries going out of business. A certain amount of money does enter into the formula of happiness, according to new research from the Gallup organization. Here's Michael Medved.
Nobody is going to get rich because of the tax cuts, but you'll have more disposable income. And there is a study which is based on a Gallup World Poll that surveys people in 164 countries. And what the survey shows, and this is fascinating, just published by Julie Ray over at Gallup, is that there is what they call a satiation point, where you're satisfied, where you're satiated, at which higher household incomes don't generate more happiness. Those points vary depending on the country that people live in. In the wealthier countries, of course, it's higher. But globally, the researchers find that satiation occurs at about $95,000 a year income. In other words, if you earn more than $95,000 a year, it does not necessarily increase your happiness. And in fact, beyond a certain point for most people, earning lots and lots of money decreases your happiness. Why would that be? The findings were published last month in Nature Human Behavior. It's a British publication. And they're based on interviews with more than 1.7 million adults aged 15 and older. The study's authors include the Gallup's senior scientist, Ed Diener. It's all based on Nobel Prize winners Angus Deaton and Daniel Kahneman, who have found previous research showing links between income and life evaluations in the U.S. They are professors at Purdue in Virginia. The researchers sought to discern whether happiness rises indefinitely with income or whether there's a point at which higher incomes no longer lead to greater well-being. And they found that that point was there. The reason that they assume that higher income past a certain point no longer contributes to happiness and may even lead in the wrong direction is that people work longer hours, there's more demands on time, there are heavier workloads, and greater responsibility just basically trying to protect your investments. If you have money that you've accumulated, you have to worry about it. And it's the same kind of thing that you can talk about countries. Countries that are very powerful and control a lot of territory tend to worry more about national defense than Belgium. Now, should Belgium worry about national defense? Yeah, it got stepped on and squashed in both World War I and World War II. But the same way that you earn a lot of money, it's possible that simply having more to protect ends up moving you in the opposite direction in happiness.
Thanks for joining us at the Town Hall Review. Catch up on old episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. Start at our site and subscribe to our Apple podcast or via Stitcher or SoundCloud or Google Play. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richard, David Posian, Chanda Chisala, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Boy, they got a lot of producers on this, and I haven't got one on my show. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Join us next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the weekend review program from the perspective you can trust.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.